Welcome to the Better Money, Better World Show, a podcast project of Impact Capital Managers, or ICM. ICM is a group of investors who believe that by solving the world's greatest challenges, we will generate market-leading returns for investors while bending the arc of human history towards sustainability and justice. ICM members have backed companies ranging from Tesla to Coursera to Vital Farms. Collectively, ICM's 100-plus members manage over $90 billion. I'm your host, Daniel Pianco, a co-founder of ICM. My day job is as co-founder of Achieve Partners, a leading investor in education and human capital. Here on Better Money, Better World, we'll explore the stories of our investor members, the companies we're building, and the limited partners allocating money to investors who don't just seek alpha, but also to leverage their capital to build a better world. Welcome to the Better Money, Better World podcast. Pleased to be joined today by Vikas Raj, who is the founder and managing partner of Resilience VC. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's really good to be here.
Let's start with the name, Resilience VC. Why did you pick that name? And walk through a deal that epitomizes your approach to investing and strategy.
So maybe like in a sentence, what is Resilience VC to give you to then get into the name? So Resilience VC is a seed stage fintech fund. We're based out of DC and we have a singular goal. It's an ambitious goal, but it's a singular goal, which is really we support visionary entrepreneurs that are using the newest technologies, the newest business models to build financial resilience for un and underserved Americans. That's low to moderate income Americans. That's micro and small businesses. That's the folks in this country that don't have the financial tools they need to thrive and build through inevitable shocks and stressors of life. We think startups have something to say about that. We go out and find those startups and support them. Why resilience specifically? Why are we called Resilience VC? In some ways, it's sort of like the distillation of the work that I've been doing in financial services for all for my whole career. I started in the microfinance space. I was an investment banker and I worked in the hedge fund world, but then I working in financial services for all in the microfinance space now almost 20 years ago, which was really a business model innovation focused around financial inclusion. It was getting credit to people using a totally new business model that lowered costs and lowered credit underwriting. Well, didn't lower credit underwriting standards. It expanded credit underwriting in a way that allowed more people to get access. My next sort of step in my career was ultimately running Axion's Venture Lab, and we can talk more about that. But that was really a fintech for inclusion fund. The goal was to move beyond microfinance, beyond the sort of analog branch-led model into using smartphones and feature phones and the internet to get the rest of the world included in the financial system. In some ways, the natural next step of that is now leveraging that technology and other new kinds of technology to actually do what we always meant by financial inclusion, which I deem financial resilience. It's making financial tools actually do what they should be doing, which is seeing people through the inevitable shocks of life, allowing them to build for the long term. So what we focus on is really what we think is the point here, which is helping people weather volatility by increasing income, building long-term net worth, and lowering risk. You and I, before we started recording, talked about our mutual friend, Avi Karnani. So let me use his company as an example of what we like. Avi's the founder of a company called Alice that helps hourly workers to essentially access the tax benefit of their commute without having to go through an extended and often impossible sign-up procedure, but also without having to put away the money up front. An Alice end customer, an employee, gets out of the subway, confirms that that ride was to work, and get the tax benefit of that spend in their next paycheck. Totally frictionless and no requirement to put away money up front. What that means is it's giving, could be $200, $500, $1,000 in additional take-home pay to deskless workers, to service workers, busboys in the back of the Chopped, the barista at Jeffrey's Coffee or Gregory's Coffee, without really needing to have a PhD or have to go through any big behavior change. For us, that's a direct tie to new income, new cash in the pocket of these service workers that will give them more of a cash cushion the next time the roof caves in or their car breaks down. That's really what we're doing. We're trying to find great innovators that are figuring out how to get more cash in people's pocket, more long-term net worth, lower risk, so that they can live better and more resilient lives.
Let's keep going with that example. So you're effectively getting people more money out of their pay, or taking advantage of a tax break that they probably weren't taking advantage of in before, in order to put more take-home pay in their pocket. That's a great outcome. How do you track impact related to that? Or how do you then tie that back to like an impact strategy?
So the sort of through line to everything we do is this idea of resilience building and financial resilience building. Every time I talk to a company, and I'm doing this within the first 5 or 10 minutes of talking to a company, I am evaluating whether or not they are using financial services in some way to drive one of these three very specific outcomes, which again are more net income, so higher revenue, lower expense, more net worth, that could be long-term savings, that could be investments, it could be employee ownership, or lower risk, which often looks like insurance or sort of shared savings pools in some way. To us, those are the sort of drivers of resilience, and a company has to drive one of those things using fintech innovation. Once we've invested, we are literally tracking the what we call resilience dollars generated by that business. And it's not rocket science, and frankly, we're going to get better and better at this. But right now, we're really just saying, okay, for Alice, how many dollars are now in people's pockets that were not before? That's a resilience dollar. If I invest in an insurance business or an extended car warranty business, well, I'm going to see effectively how much additional risk protection they got by virtue of having a policy they wouldn't have had otherwise, or that's significantly cheaper than it would have been otherwise. We track that across each of our categories, net income, net worth, and risk. And then we put all of that together, knowing that it's sort of an imperfect summation of all of the resilience that we're creating. And we call that resilience dollars. And it's sort of like the ultimate clarifying mechanism for us. We find that we avoid a lot of impact risk by making sure that we're tying all the way to the end, tying all the way to how many resilience dollars are being created by the company.
That's really fascinating. Now, the thing about fintech is it tends to be dominated by some really big outcomes. And you have had some really big outcomes. Yeah, it sounds like you invest like 80, 90 companies over your career. You've had a couple real unicorns. Can you describe a success you had in a prior fund, not just like Alice at the early stage, kind of growth stage, but like, okay, how does this look, you know, 3, 5, 7 years down the road when they go public or get an exit at that size?
Yeah, we could talk more about previous funds, but you know, before co-founding Resilience VC, I co-led Axion Venture Lab, which is a global C-stage fintech fund that sat within Axion International, which is a global nonprofit focused on financial services. One of the companies that I invested in at Axion was called SelfLender at the time, now called Self. It's a company that was building sort of hybrid savings credit products for low to moderate income Americans. The way the product works is you take a loan, the principal goes into a fixed deposit account that over 6, 9, 12 months is repaid. At the end of that 6, 9, 12 months, you've got real savings to your name, but you also have a new credit line on your credit score that allows you to build credit over time. It could be 50, 60, 70 points if your credit damaged. It could be a straight path if your credit invisible to 650 points or more. This is a company that was exclusively focused on low to moderate income Americans. Their average customer is lower than $30,000 of annual household income. We invested at the seed stage. I was a board observer. We did a lot of work below the board level to help this company, particularly on product roadmap as it moved from credit builder loan to secured card to unsecured card. When we invested, it was pretty small. Again, seed business, it went on to be a unicorn, generating great returns for our investors, but also a statement to the market that you could build a company that was focused on this customer, that was doing right by this customer, but was ultimately scalable and generated great returns for investors.
You wrote a really interesting piece a few weeks ago, I mean, months ago, about Chime, which just went public, and how that was sort of like an impact company, impact fintech company that went public, right? But how you said, well, it's really just a friendly bank to the underbanked population. What do you think real victory is going to look like in 3 to 5 years for your strategy?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to clarify, Chime's a great story. It's a great story for the work that I've been doing for nearly 20 years. It shows that inclusive fintech, you know, fintech company, in this case, a neobank model that is focused on the underserved, the mass market in this country, can rescale. And at some point this year, hopefully, reach public markets. You know, it's sort of product focus, it's lack of branches, no overdraft fees. It sort of changed expectations on how you can serve this customer base and generate revenue. Now, the kind of revenue that Chime generates, as your listeners might know, is what's called interchange fees. Essentially, they get a little chunk every time a Chime user swipes their card digitally or you know, in analog form. That's great. But as I talk about in the article, that's probably a start, not only from a sort of business model perspective, but also from an end sort of customer use and impact perspective. On both of those counts, Chime will need to continue to expand to do things that fill out a customer's financial journey and ultimately drive resilience. And really, that is the key word here. That is what financial services are supposed to be doing. For Chime, they've started some experimentation on sort of ancillary products that drive resilience, but there needs to be more. You know, income smoothing via payroll, embedded credit or asset-backed credit, you know, automated savings, you know, benefits access. Some of this might happen via Chime directly. Some of this might happen with Chime as a platform that other fintechs sit on top of. You know, I think a true victory for financial resilience innovation is when Chime is that full suite. It has that sort of full set of services that low to moderate income Americans need to get through the day, week, month, so that they are meeting cash flow imbalances in the short term, and they're able to build wealth and stability in the long term.
It's almost like you're competing with a lot of legacy financial players. But at the same time, you know, it's pretty. You have a pretty remarkable list of LPs that actually represent a lot of those traditional financial interests, like MetLife, Discover, or a number of other large financial institutions. Can you talk about what brought these LPs to resilience?
Yeah, we got extraordinarily lucky with what is a Fund One, right? We just finished raising Resilience VC Fund One at the end of last year. We raised a little over $58 million towards a strategy. And we have just like incredibly supportive LPs, MetLife, Discover, Ally Bank, Skoll Foundation, Blue Haven Initiative. Some of these are folks that have backed us in previous funds at Axion. So it's an honor to be able to work with these institutions. I think maybe like the three things I can think of that brought those investors on, you know, one is, we've just been doing this for a really long time. So my co-founder and I, Tyra, have been managing funds together for almost 12 years, literally seed stage fintech for good funds. The previous one was really fintech for inclusion. This is fintech for resilience, as I said, the sort of next iteration. But I think we've proven that we have a real rigor, sort of a real sharp pencil rigor when we look at deals. We have a lot of experience in networks that are really required to both find and then ultimately invest in and support through exit the best companies. I think there's also, maybe the second point is that there's also there's no risk of like greenwashing happening here. I left my job 19 years ago at a hedge fund in Stamford, Connecticut to go help to start a microlending business and kind of been at it back and forth a little bit, but at it ever since. So I think when people talk to us, they know that we're not in this to be a fintech fund with an impact slide. We're trying to be a top tier, top decile in terms of performance fintech fund that is very, very, very clear. And we're not backing away from this, no matter what the environment looks like, that we are only going to invest in companies that are serving low to moderate income Americans or micro businesses, and they're doing right by those businesses and driving financial resilience. So people, I think investors appreciate that. And then maybe the final thing, and this is something I think about more and more now that we're past the fundraise, we're trying to build an institution, like not just a fund. We're trying to build a firm, I guess, not just a fund. And that means a firm that is going to be able to optimize through market cycles and sort of tackle this problem systematically as it evolves. And that means hiring a great team, having the right tech stack, having the right back office, and sort of thinking long term, because boy, we're not, our $58 million fund is not going to come close to solving this problem. Hopefully we can make the smallest dent in it. But this is a long-term project here, and we're building for the long-term, and we're looking for long-term partners. And I think the partners we have ultimately share this belief that backing technology businesses that help people earn more, save more, lower risk is really good for business, because it's a massive market with real unit economics over time, and it's good for those people. It's good for the country. So
I think I'm going to know your answer to this, but based on what you just said, but there are other partners as well in your companies, which is mainstream venture capitalists who come into your deals, which are really important to achieving your returns. You have a situation where your impact focus and the purely financial focus of your co-investors differ, and how do you deal with that?
The honest answer is I don't have like a specific example for you of when we have invested in a company early and then we've had the B come in or the C come in and say, the hell are you guys doing? We're going to orient this company towards high net worths now, even though they've been making money serving low to moderate income Americans. So we're going to triple the price that we're charging this customer. And the reason for that is that we're investing in companies. We don't invest in like Tesla model businesses where the end customer that we seek to serve is like trickled down to eventually. You know, you start with the premium model, and then, yeah, eventually you can cut costs enough that you can serve the lower income customer. We only invest where the company is able to build a business by responsibly serving the mass market, by responsibly serving low to moderate income Americans. And we invest so early, we're really seed investors, that we're sort of gearing that between the seed and the A and the seed and the B, so that by the time a Series B investor is coming in with a $20 million check, they're investing into the business that we've been working to prove. They're investing in the idea that they can actually make money by responsibly serving this customer with a financial product. If they didn't believe it, they wouldn't invest. By the time they're investing, they've made their peace with this approach, and they're just trying to put wood on the fire. As long as the impact and the business success is sort of intrinsic in the model, by the time the Series B is coming in, there's no daylight. They want to do what we've already sort of geared the business to do.
All right. Now, this, of course, leads to how do you grow fintech companies big enough? Because, you know, financial services businesses have a reputation for moving slowly. How do you bring kind of a venture capital return profile to these slower moving business models serving the underserved?
Well, I think you start with the fact that this is a massive market that's undergoing a real secular shift that is sort of undeniable. There's $20 trillion plus of consumer spend flows that go through financial products. When we look at sort of deposit growth over the last half a decade, it's dramatically higher in digital versus analog, sort of incumbent financial institutions. But the vast majority of financial services still comes from a small set of massive incumbent institutions. Many of them are surprisingly analog. And tens of millions of Americans feel underserved by the financial system. We know that they're not getting what they need from the financial system. So this isn't like disrupting a sleepy old market. This is solving this sort of massive pain point that is happening now. I think of venture as this interesting intellectual, it's not a tension, but it's like sort of considering the really short term and the really long term, right? Like you have to, in the very short term, you're not trying to uproot systems. You are trying to build a value proposition for an end customer. And startups do not work because they're pretty thinly capitalized in the grand scheme of things. And they have really tight little teams that are running after these problems. They don't work unless you're targeting a really specific user problem, commuter tax access, right? Rent reporting, you know, savings automation, and you're building trust and engagement quickly so you can go prove revenues. You can go raise your next round of capital, right? So in the short term, you got to get in there, you got to prove value. And then you sort of have to consider the long term, which is like throw your imagination forward 8 years, 10 years to the exit to say, is this company going to apply this short term value proposition, be able to build on top of it to build a massive business. And boy, if I'm looking at the biggest opportunities there are in the economy today, it's like undeniable that in 7 to 10 years, the financial services market is going to look very different for these customers, because right now they're dramatically underserved. So I feel really good about companies that are building value propositions in the short term and then building towards serving one of the massive sort of like latent markets there is in the United States.
It's almost like by going after the blue ocean strategy, you're succeeding where others aren't going.
Yes, except to succeed in a blue ocean strategy, you need to like start with a really good canoe or something. I don't know, a really good fishing rod. You have to be focused on the space around you building a value proposition, but it's really nice to do that sitting in a big blue ocean.
I don't think we should take this analogy any further, but
maybe there's like a lifeboat involved. There's like a pool. I don't know. There's like a tank sitting within the ocean.
A sturdy boat on the blue ocean is going to be the next Columbia Business School essay from, from Professor Raj. All right. Speaking of blue oceans, I couldn't not ask about artificial intelligence in this kind of context of what we just discussed. How will AI help or hurt underserved communities from a financial services perspective? I feel like if you don't have the video, but Vikas is like rubbing his temples in like questioning what to do here.
It's funny just because like we'll stop this podcast recording and then I'll go downstairs and talk to my family about AI. It's what we have to be thinking about in every facet of our lives. Not just financial services, you know, there's the personal, there's what it's going to do to all jobs, there's the robot takeover fears that we all are also struggling with. I want to talk about what AI means for startups, but I think it's worth just thinking about in the first place what AI and automation could mean in financial services. Like there is 8 million or so people that work in the financial services industry in the US, and they make on average, I think it's $85,000 to $90,000 a year on average. So that is, you're probably better at math than I am, Dan, but it's something like $750 billion of spend, $760 billion of spend on financial services employees. A lot of these folks are loan officers. They're middle management at a small bank. I think AI is going to over time do a lot of those jobs. There's a sort of like big question here on what happens to the future of the financial services industry writ large as AI does more. I think for startups, it's probably the other side of that coin, right? Which is, hey, we have this opportunity to go in and take this industry over. I have 8 companies in this portfolio so far. We'll have about 25. Every one of my 8 companies is already using AI every day, at least somewhere between the back end and the front. And definitely in the back end and sometimes drifting towards the front end. That could be optimization for marketing. That could be some version of an agent that is working with the customer around a specific transaction or ingesting certain information. It could be customer service. It could be fraud detection. So every one of my companies, and I'd venture to say most companies that VCs are looking at the early stage are using AI in some dramatic way to lower costs, be more efficient, drive a better value proposition for the end customer. And, you know, we used to talk about 10 years ago that cloud was changing the math on what it took to start a startup. And that math just went down 90% with AI. I mean, the amount of operating leverage in these startups now is phenomenal based on AI, especially if you're starting native AI. So you can do a lot with little in terms of capital and resources with AI. And that's really exciting. I think the risk is real. I wrote an article and did an interview on my podcast with the CEO of a company called Fairplay. We talked about this risk of AI underwriting that's trained on biased data and that is getting now reinforced through AI, not improved. So we need to push for more transparency, more understanding of how AI models are really driving financial services. And there's this sort of danger of predatory precision, you know, targeting users at their most financially vulnerable because you know so much about them. In some ways, it's just the next step of some of the risks we've seen over many years in this space. So AI can dramatically reduce costs. It can dramatically increase reach, but we need to be super intentional, and investors like us need to be super aware about the ethics of it. and the oversight of it.
Maybe you could paint your utopian vision then. Like everyone knows what the downside is or thinks they are. Is there a utopian vision, or are we just, to quote the French, screwed?
I think there's a utopian vision. I think, again, taking like my own personal like fears about AI out of it and the robot invasion and all that out of it, I think we're not that far off from the prize that was promised when we first started thinking about financial health and financial resilience and financial inclusion, which is a benevolent agent that sits on your shoulder and is optimizing. It is a full-time financial resilience engine that is always on, and it is nearly free, and it is a financial co-pilot that helps you optimize everything in your financial life at every moment. Claiming benefits, avoiding fees, moving your low-yield savings account to a high-yield savings account at the right time because rates have changed, paying down debt, investing in the right ETF. And this is something that could go direct to consumer. It could live in payroll systems. It could live in benefit portals, but it could totally flip the script and make the set of financial rules that have not always worked for low to moderate income Americans finally work, because it removes all the friction and actually just makes the right decision for you at the right time. That could be incredibly powerful.
Or at least gives you the information to make the right decision.
Yeah. I'll take it a step further than that, which might be controversial, which is, it's not necessarily just an information issue. It's an execution issue. You know, you might know, Dan, that you have $8,000 sitting in your checking account that, based on your transaction history, half of which could probably go to a money market account generating a higher yield. You're not doing it because you got a million other things to do. And the difference for a low to moderate income American of putting that $4,000 in a high yield account versus leaving it in their checking account is dramatic, based on the amount of cash people typically have, of, you know, additional savings people actually have, and how desperately people need the ability to see their way through financial calamity. So it's not just the information. In some ways, I feel like the information is out there, although it's going to improve with AI. It's also the ability to execute on it.
Agents doing your work for you. Now, a lot of this could, you know, historically, you know, folks from the left have really viewed regulation as a way to accomplish some of the things you're talking about. And with the current administration, we're approaching a time with severe deregulation. How do you see that shift impacting AI, what you're doing today, and how your companies will compete long-term with these behemoths?
Yeah. Let me start by saying, as a fund and for our companies, we don't rely on like friendly policy to do this work. Our thesis is built on a massive market gap, massive user need, and the idea that private markets and innovation can solve those needs. And we try to really shine a light on the companies that are doing it most responsibly and only support those, and hopefully move the industry in the right direction by doing that, which, it's kind of interesting, I've found is quite it's an approach that is sort of attractive across the aisle. It's a nonpartisan approach. Having said that, I think I'd say the Trump administration has been taking a pretty, in general, sort of deregulatory approach to financial services. As many of your listeners probably know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is really the sort of consumer watchdog in financial services that has now been around for some time, has kind of effectively been neutered under the Trump administration, which means that the entity that you could call if your bank overcharged you or you couldn't get your money out of your savings account doesn't exist anymore, practically. And that's tough, just from a basic like consumer watchdog principle. And then beyond that, the CFPB started to do things, and I won't weigh in on the appropriateness of their reach, but they started to do things around open banking, around overdraft, that by and large seemed to have potential to really help customers. So I think what that means is our role as investors that actually care about these end customers, both because we care about the impact and we know it's good for business, it's all the more important because we need to be there to really make sure we're focusing energies on responsibly serving this customer. I will say the only place we've really seen sort of proactive energy from the Trump administration is this stable genius bill. I don't know if this is something you've spent any time on. Essentially, one version of it was just passed in Senate. It's stable coin legislation that puts guidelines around digital currency that's backed by the dollar. And it's sort of interesting to see that that's the one thing that's getting through. I have some concerns, I think, about how that policy is actually going to affect the financial system and create potentially some systemic risk. That's the one place where there is action, and frankly, it has some risk around it. But yeah, you know, ultimately, this deregulatory sort of reflex doesn't let us off the hook. It has to sharpen our focus on this end customer and our focus on making sure that our companies are doing right by them.
You brought up crypto, and I hate to bring it up at the tail end, and this will be my second to last question for you. Folks like Core VC and others have really thought that crypto will help solve a lot of these issues. We've had them on the show. And you know, if you look at sort of use of Bitcoin or use of Ethereum, it's primarily in non-developed markets. How do you think about crypto as in this context?
I haven't listened to the episode with Core, and I'd love to hear. I should listen to that and make sure I understand what they're excited about in crypto. For me, I still struggle to see the core for the U.S. customer, the U.S. low to moderate income customer, a core underlying financial resilience building value proposition in crypto writ large. Now, I understand with things like stablecoin, there's sort of a potential financial inclusion benefit that's really an infrastructure one. But we now live in a world with real-time payments, in a country with real-time payments and, you know, Zelle and FedNow. So some of the juice has already been squeezed out of that infrastructure benefit. But I can see the benefit, you know, of a stable coin sort of making people's money movement even more frictionless. But crypto, the ability to own highly speculative assets more easily, I just don't quite see how that is building something sustainably better for low-income Americans right now.
Maybe you'll have that debate on the next episode of your podcast called The Pinks, where you debate ethical choices of the future of fintech. But
first, let me correct you, Dan, that it's pronounced the Knicks. And not just because the Knicks have game two tonight, and it's a really big night. So go Knicks. But it's also, that was the, it's spelled PNYX because that was the assembly in ancient Greece where bills were debated.
Go Knicks as well. I got two New York fans. Go New York, go New York, go. Speaking of New York, we mentioned you're a professor at Columbia Business School earlier. You see a lot of folks come through, and I'm sure a lot of people want to be sitting in your seat 20 years hence as you are. What advice do you give to that second year MBA student about, you know, becoming a VC, investing in something like the future of financial services for the underserved? What advice do you give to those folks?
Yeah, it's something, I mean, I get this question a lot from my students. It's a really weird time to be graduating from undergrad or business school. I think a lot of the roles that people graduating from business school typically got, you know, associates at investment banks or consulting companies, a lot of those are being upended by AI. Increasingly, those tasks are being done with technology, which means the onus is on graduates to, I think, get to that decision-making role where AI can really be optimized and be quite useful by learning to think, by learning to solve problems, by learning to ingest more and more inputs and more stimulus and actually come up with the right strategy, the right decision. You can't just start by making decisions, graduate business school, making decisions. You need to be informed. And I think the best way to do that, the best experience, is to go get close to the problem. So invariably, my advice to MBA grads is like, cool, you were a banker for 2 years, or you worked at a private equity fund for 2 years. Go work at a startup. Go see this on the ground. Go deal with the nitty-gnatty problems that happen when you're actually trying to run your own company. And if you care about fintech, if you care about financial resilience, go work at a startup that is focused on serving low to moderate income Americans or wherever they are in the world, wherever these customers are in the world, and go help them. Go figure out how to build a product that actually helps those customers. Get obsessed with unit economics and end value proposition and user outcomes. That will really give you the experience you need to make the decisions later in your career, to actually support companies later in your career. I think that's the best thing to do is go do it. Go work at a startup, actually do the work.
Get your hands dirty, get operating experience, because that's what drives value. Well, Vikas, this has been great. Thank you so much for making the time, and appreciate all you're doing to bring financial inclusion to Americans who don't have it today.
Thanks, Dan. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to Better Money, Better World, a podcast project of Achieve Partners and Impact Capital Managers. If you enjoyed today's conversation and want to learn more about how investing for impact is driving returns, come visit us at www.impactcapitalmanagers.com.